Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Gross domestic product and the Group of Eight on the broadcast today. Also, Canadian oil and another way to characterize the financial crisis. Reckless endangerment is a pretty good phrase. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Thursday. It's the 26th of May today. And if there is one thing you can count on with government numbers on the economy, it's that they're going to change. Reports like the one that came out this morning on gross domestic product almost always get revised. That was the hope last month when the Commerce Department released its preview of first quarter GDP. A lot of people figure the fairly anemic growth rate of 1.8% would be adjusted upward after some more number crunching. Turns out what looked like a struggling economy really was, because the number again this morning was 1.8%. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has the story.
It's starting to sound like that old song had it right, there ain't no cure for the summertime blues. For the second straight year, we're heading into a season that's not looking as hot as had been forecast, economically speaking.
We came into this year with very high hopes, and those hopes are being eroded away.
Ken Mayland at Clearview Economics says even more discouraging were some numbers that did get revised. Consumer spending was considerably weaker than originally estimated, and more inventory backed up on shelves. Neither bode well for the near future. Standard & Poor's chief economist David Weiss says a slow recovery like this remains vulnerable.
Obviously, there's a shot that we could go back into recession. I don't think it'll happen on its own.
But Weiss worries we could get pushed back into the rut by sustained higher gas prices, the European debt crisis, or too big of a drag on economic growth from higher taxes or deep spending cuts. Government spending already shrank by 5% in the first 3 months of the year, and Clearview's Ken Mayland says the economy could be fighting more severe cuts in the second half of the year.
A lot of people might say, yeah, we should reduce government spending, rah, 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 for that. At the same time, that spending is somebody's income, income that won't be spent.
There's always this, though. S&P's David Weiss points out it could be worse, and is, in fact, in most other developed countries.
North America will probably have much stronger growth this year than Europe, certainly than Japan, which has gone back into recession as a result of the disaster over there. We may be a sick horse, but we're still the fastest horse in the race.
I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
So along those lines, in the face of a slowdown here and in much of the rest of the world, one would think a meeting of the world's biggest economies in France this week would be all economy all the time. One would be wrong if one thought that. From the European desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
These heads of the G8 group of countries, half of them European, have a big agenda. The Arab Spring, nuclear power, climate change, internet regulation. Summit watcher Sean Rickard of the Cranfield School of Management is dismayed. He says the leaders aren't focusing laser-like on the global economy.
Without a thriving global economy, many of the political leaders' abilities to do something on those other issues tends to wane.
Those other issues are all critical, says Bob McGee of Independent Strategy, but he also believes the summiteers are not paying enough attention to the number one question.
Whether the global economy is really recovering and what coordinated policy action can be taken to sustain growth in the major economies.
And Sean Rickard says the G8 looks increasingly irrelevant. The G20 group of developed and rapidly emerging economies is the one to watch.
How can we be sensibly talking about the future without involving, you know, what are going to be the giants tomorrow? Certainly China, India, Brazil.
Yesterday, President Obama insisted the rise of China and India does not mean the demise of American and European influence. The G8 is supposed to prove that point. But today, investors ignored the gathering. One analyst told me, we're much more interested in the G20 meeting later this year. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The best hope to keep the economy from slowing down even more would seem to be getting more people working. And to that end, Republicans in the House of Representatives introduced what they're calling a new job creation plan today. The ideas in the proposal aren't exactly new. Some of them were in the GOP's Pledge to America last year. So we asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer to find out how, exactly, things like lowering the top corporate tax rate to 25% might create some more jobs.
For some economists, it's a no-brainer. Of course corporations would plow money from a tax cut back into the business, creating jobs, and that would start a ripple effect. Robert Dye is senior economist at PNC Bank.
Tax cuts create jobs. Jobs create income. Income creates more jobs than other companies.
Dye says that was the rationale for tax cuts that were included in a compromise agreement between President Obama and congressional Republicans late last year. Does that mean tax cuts create jobs? Bill Gentry says, not necessarily. He teaches economics at Williams College. He says many companies are sitting on piles of cash right now and not hiring. He doesn't think extra money from a tax cut would change that. Gentry says things would be different in a healthier economy.
Because if the economy is booming and companies are saying, wow, we need cash, then that would be a different story.
Gentry says right now companies would be more likely to use money from a tax break to buy back stock or increase dividends for shareholders. But Nomura Securities chief economist David Ressler says, hey, what's wrong with that? Ressler says the shareholders would use the money to create jobs.
They're going to invest it in either other companies or they're going to use some of that money to buy goods and services that will require increased production by somebody.
But would that somebody be in the U.S.? Or would the shareholder invest the money abroad? Or use it to buy something made in China? More tough questions for economists to chew over. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
A correction now on our story earlier this week about TwitPic. That's an app that lets you tweet your photos. We said the company had the exclusive right to distribute, that is, sell your pictures. Not so. TwitPic's terms of service do say owners retain full rights to distribute their own work, should they so choose. A snapshot of Wall Street at day's end shows the major indices in the green. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Hiring undocumented immigrants just got more expensive. From the United States Supreme Court today came a ruling that upholds an Arizona law on illegal workers. The justices said companies can be required to use a federal database to verify somebody's status, and companies can be punished for knowingly hiring illegal immigrants. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has the details.
The Supreme Court says states can use their licensing laws to punish employers. In Arizona, this is known as the business death penalty, where a license is revoked if a business hires undocumented workers. Mark Krikorian is with the Center for Immigration Studies, which favors tighter immigration policies.
It's repeated violations of the law that result in their business license potentially being yanked, and frankly, they deserve it.
On a practical level, businesses in Arizona have already been operating under the law for 4 years. Glenn Hammer is president of the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry. He says Arizona companies are now in the habit of using the federal E-Verify database to check employment eligibility.
Arizona companies use E-Verify at least on a per capita basis at a greater percentage than any other state.
The Supreme Court decision may have a bigger impact outside of Arizona. Hammer expects other states will draft similar laws requiring all employers to check the E-Verify system when hiring workers. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
We are, as presidents as far back as Richard Nixon have told us, addicted to foreign oil. Saudi Arabian oil, Mexican oil, Nigerian oil. Far and away the leading source of American crude, though, are those nice people north of the border. And Canadians want to sell us even more oil, too, via a giant new pipeline running all the way down to South Texas called the Keystone XL. There's a fight going on in Washington, though. It's about the pipeline a little bit, but mostly it's about whether we should be burning Canadian oil at all. Marketplace's Scott Tong ventured forth from our sustainability desk to Alberta to check it out.
This pipeline fight is over the most expensive oil in the world. Oil companies drilling in the Canadian oil sands typically spend $60 or more to produce one barrel of crude. It's what's called tough oil. It takes a lot of energy, geology, and fancy acronyms.
Probably the most advanced technology right now is called SAGD. Or it stands for steam-assisted gravity drainage.
Drew Ziegel-Gansberger is vice president at the Canadian oil company Cenovus. We're on a bus touring their operations in middle of nowhere Alberta. He says the world's easy oil is gone.
The oil now that people are looking for are not the nice light oil sitting in pools that you drill into and it just flows by itself.
What's left is in remote places, often way underground. As for the oil sands, they're not even a liquid.
It's basically a solid matter. It's very much like a shoe polish. It's hard, and it's, if you put it in a cup, it would be there forever. And you dump it out, it's just, it'd be like dumping some wet sand in your sandbox.
Still, processing the oil sands is worth it, because Americans import 100 barrels of crude every second. That comes out to 24,000 barrels of oil by the time this story is over, or 1 million gallons. The key ingredient to oil sands is heat. You send steam down a well, turn the sand into liquid, and then pump it up.
So this is basically a big, big boiler.
The steam source runs almost 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Great big fire.
This is where we're burning natural gas. If you look at a normal barbecue, your barbecue is probably about 30 or 40,000 BTU of heat, maybe. This one generator is 250 million. It's a massive amount of energy.
And there's the rub. In some cases, the energy put in equals what you get out. Not worth it, says Calgary author Andrew Nikiforuk. His book is called Tar Sands.
The returns are absolutely minimal. It takes one barrel of oil or oil equivalent to get 1.5 barrels. Some projects, some steam plants are getting even negative returns.
Energy use makes the oil sands process emit 17% more greenhouse gases than normal oil, according to a U.S. government study. And critics say that makes for one of the dirtiest crudes in the world, not to mention the chemical wastewater and the clearing of forests for mining. Canadian activist Danielle Droitsch is with the Pembina Institute.
It's similar to Venezuela. It is similar to Nigerian oil. So it's sort of the worst of the worst.
Droitsch moved to D.C. last year, in her view, to keep the oil sands industry honest. She's fighting the expansion of a pipeline carrying Canadian oil sands crude to the United States. And for now, it is stalled. The application's been at the State Department for 33 months. Opponents like Droitsch think choking off supply will help choke off oil addiction quickly. But the reality of driving suggests maybe not. Analyst Jim Burkhardt at IHS Cambridge Energy says most of us own our cars for a decade or more, so it'll take a long time to retire a whole generation of oil guzzlers.
So even if we have stunning success in electric vehicles, it will take decades before we see that reduce overall global oil demand.
That's why every big oil company in the world is investing in Canada's oil sands. And leading the surge, Drew Ziegel-Gansberger at Cenovus.
We can expand as quick as 20 times in less than a decade. Right now, for the foreseeable future, our foot is on the gas.
Perfectly fine pun, which I will butcher by saying down the road there's a danger sign, and it reads pipeline uncertainty. Calgary analyst David Yeager.
There comes a point where if you can't move this oil, you've got to say, yeah, this is a problem. If I can't get access to markets, there's no point.
So to push the pipeline, industry has taken out ads like this.
What would you think if I told you we import more oil from Canada by far than from any other country in the world?
That's great, Canada.
The obvious pitch? Canada. So not the Middle East. And they're also playing the China card. If the Americans don't want Canadian crude, they'll sell it to those guys. And the stakes are high for the other side, too. Danielle Droitsch at the Pembina Institute says this is no longer just about a pipeline. It's fundamentally about the oil sands and about climate.
This pipeline is really about whether this administration is serious about climate policy when it comes to reducing oil dependence. That's sort of what this has become.
Word is the Obama administration considers this a lose-lose situation. Either they anger environmentalists or energy users. The pipeline decision is expected by December. Till then, the energy pros in Canada will be mining and steaming away. In Alberta, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up,
Many of the lawmakers that supported the companies maintained that the taxpayer would never have to pay a dime to cover them.
The companies in question are Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which, of course, taxpayers now own. But first, let's do the numbers. Signs that high-end consumers are spending again helped lift markets today in the face of that GDP report. The Dow Industrials edged up 8 points, less than a tenth percent, settled at 12,402. The blue chips did. The Nasdaq rose 21 points, 0.75%, 2782. At the bell, the S&P 500 advanced 5 points, 0.4%, wrapped up trading at 1325. Tiffany set the tone after reporting first quarter sales rose 20%. Shares of the luxury retailer sparkled up more than 8.5% today. Elsewhere, shares of Microsoft booted up nearly 2% after a high-profile hedge fund manager said CEO Steve Ballmer ought to go. Google unveiled its new mobile payment system. Investors were nonplussed. Shares dropped a little more than a third of 1%. And a little trivia now. The Dow Jones Industrial Average turns 115 years old today. Only one company has been a part of the Dow since the beginning. Any guesses? Go ahead. I'll wait. Take your time. GE shares up more than 1% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for April. The National Association of Realtors releases its monthly pending home sales index. And a nationwide productivity vacuum is expected tomorrow afternoon as civilians flee the confines of work to embark on a three-day odyssey of barbecue beaches and the Hangover Part 2. Yes, Memorial Day weekend and the start of summer. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Pittsburgh-based H.J. Hines said today its quarterly profits were up, just not up enough. So it's going to close five factories, two of which are here in the United States, cut about 1,000 jobs overall. And the problems go well beyond ketchup, as Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
In the U.S., the name Hines is known for one thing.
Ketchup! I just gotta ketchup!
But in the rest of the world, Hines is known for lots of products. Morningstar analyst Aaron Lash says 60% of Heinz's sales are now generated outside the U.S.
They sell beans in the U.K., and they sell infant and nutritional products as well as like soy sauce over in emerging and developing markets. So their product portfolio is definitely much broader than what we see over here.
Here or there, the ingredients that go into those products have gotten more expensive. Milk, cheese, sweeteners, and oils all cost more. To cope, Heinz announced it'll shutter factories and lay off workers. And it's also been inching prices higher. But Wells Fargo economist Mark Vittner says as raw material costs increase, there's a limit to how much companies can pass on to us.
The prices that they're having to pay for raw materials are going up about 5%. And they're really lucky if they can get 2 to 3% increases on their final price.
Why not just dump it all on consumers?
So there's just not a whole lot of discretionary purchasing power to pay higher prices.
Vittner's not suggesting that we'll go without our favorite foods just yet. But the higher prices could have us all trying to squeeze just a little more out of that ketchup bottle. Vittner says companies will have to do the same. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
You know those deal-a-day offers? Groupon is probably the most famous one. Google's getting into the game, too. And all there are more than 300 companies doing it, plus one for newspapers, who see the group buying market as a way to make up for their disappearing advertising dollars. From WBUR in Boston, Kurt Nickisch reports that the Boston Globe has launched its own service.
It was the Boston Globe that famously turned down a chance to start Monster.com, which went on to devour their classifieds revenue. Today, the Globe's chief advertising officer, Lisa DeSisto, is kicking herself about group buying.
Well, sure, I wish we would have thought of it earlier, but we still think we have an opportunity to be really competitive here.
DeSisto says unlike many newbie group buying services, newspapers have long cultivated relationships with local advertisers. And she says newspapers already have a built-in customer base, subscribers, and website visitors.
So if you're reading a restaurant review, we want to give people the opportunity to get a deal at that restaurant while they're there reading the review.
The Boston Globe's not the first newspaper to try this marketing phenomenon. The San Diego Union-Tribune started one that's now outselling Groupon and Living Social in its market. Peter Krasilovsky is an analyst at the media research firm BIA Kelsey. He says group buyer sites are increasingly taking on newspapers. Just look at Groupon's recent partnership with an events and concert promoter. He says group buying services want to become more than just an online coupon service.
Well, newspapers have been positioning themselves as city guides. So, yeah, they're going to have a head-to-head collision.
Krasilovsky says it's not too late for newspapers to join the fray. Most group buyers tend to be educated women, just the tip of the iceberg of potential customers. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nikisch for Marketplace.
It's not really a question of what happened to cause the financial crisis anymore, right? There was a housing crash, irresponsible lending and borrowing, egregious violations of common sense and sound financial practices. Another way to put it might be reckless endangerment, which, as it happens, is the title of New York Times reporter Gretchen Morgenson's new book on the crisis and its causes. Gretchen, good to have you back.
Anytime.
There are, of course, villains to go around, and you get to them in turn in the course of this book, but you spend a lot of time talking about housing and real estate, and more specifically, the drive that we had in this country in the late 90s to get more Americans to own their own homes.
Yes. That was, I think, the door that was opened to the kinds of practices that really contributed to the losses that we're now counting and the crisis that we're still living through. And, you know, what we argue in the book is that this American dream was really a way for a lot of companies, a lot of participants to make a tremendous amount of money for themselves while putting the American dreamers, the people who wanted to own the homes, at peril.
Your main character here is a guy by the name of Jim Johnson, the head of Fannie Mae, the big government mortgage company. Lay out his role and that company's role in how we got to where we are today.
Okay, so back in the early 90s, we had just been through another financial crisis, and it involved SNL's Savings and Loan Associations. There was a bit of soul searching that was going on in Congress at the time that we were cleaning up the SNL crisis that really sort of went to the point of, gosh, could such a crisis happen at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? So they wrote some new legislation designed to forestall any kind of a crisis at the companies. Well, the executive in charge of Fannie Mae at the time was Jim Johnson, and he was very, very assertive about making sure that the capital requirements that were set in the legislation would be low so that the company would earn more money, and that Fannie Mae got everything that it wanted in the legislation.
So here's the rearview mirror question, though. Why did regulators look the other way? Why did consumers get into these mortgages? I mean, it all seems so dunderheaded, you know?
I attribute the regulatory failures to, in some cases, regulatory capture, in which the regulators are so close to the entities they are charged with overseeing that they begin to have the same mindset. They don't want to be an adversary.
As you know, the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill says nothing at all about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Congress can't agree on what to do about them. The market is up in the air as to what taking them out of the mortgage business will mean for rates and homeownership. I mean, what are we supposed to do now?
Well, I think if we've learned anything about this crisis, it is that, you know, you really have to think twice about having the government back any kind of a private enterprise. I mean, Fannie Mae really got it down perfectly. They benefited themselves all the while wrapping themselves in the American flag and saying that they were really benefiting borrowers. Now, remember, throughout this period, from the early 90s all the way through to the end, when the taxpayers took over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, all of the executives, many of the policymakers, many of the lawmakers that supported the companies maintained that the taxpayer would never have to pay a dime to cover them. And, of course, we know how that turned out.
Gretchen Morgenson is a reporter in the business section of the New York Times. She's a columnist there as well, and she's the author of a new book with Joshua Rosner called Reckless Endangerment, about the financial crisis. Gretchen, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, of which I truly know not what to make. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg apparently gives himself a personal challenge every year. Last year, it was learning Chinese. Before that, it was wearing a tie every day. Not so hard. This year, something completely different. He's only going to eat what he kills with his own two hands. More power to him, I suppose, for wanting to get closer to the food chain. But I'm obliged to close with a line from our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore. Those Winklevoss brothers, Heidi said, the ones suing Zuckerberg for $100 million? Oh, they better look out. And that's it. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow edged up 8 points, less than a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ up 21 points, about 0.75%. The S&P 500 advanced 5 points, less than 0.5%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back here, the aforementioned Heidi Moore, Felix Salmon from Reuters, and the week that was. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.